Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
The US oil giant Chevron have won a ruling in a federal appeals court, which means they won't be required to pay out billions of dollars over pollution allegations in Ecuador. Whilst this technically marks the end of a decades-long legal battle, Chevron's opponents are adamant that their fight continues.
As the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen intensifies its bombing, with reports of 14 Yemeni children killed in airstrikes on Saturday, we look at attempts within the American Senate to challenge further arms sales to the Gulf Kingdom.
A Northern Ireland victims campaigner has launched a legal challenge to the UK's leaving the European Union amid concerns that EU peace money, which goes towards victims of the Troubles, could be discontinued in the event of Brexit.
Jonathan Pollard, a former Israeli spy, has seen his bid to overturn restrictive probation conditions refused. But just who is Jonathan Pollard?
Refugees in Germany are paying it forward. Refugee students at the Ready School for Digital Integration have developed a new app to help other refugees and asylum seekers deal with the complex paperwork they face when arriving in the country.
All that's coming up over the next half hour on today's edition of World in Focus. Last week saw the culmination of a decades-long battle with the US oil giant Chevron over accusations of pollution in Ecuador. The case, which began in the US courts, later shifted towards the Ecuadorian courts, where the Chevron Corporation was ordered to pay $18.1 billion. That was later brought down to $9.5, but Chevron contested that the case was fraudulent and ultimately took the case back to the States. Here's a clip from one of the many videos posted on Chevron's website, the Amazon Post, attacking the case against them.
Rather than doing what is right, the Ecuadorian government, together with calculating lawyers and deceitful activist groups, are seeking to blame a big oil company and cash in. It's time for Petroecuador and the Ecuadorian government to stop pointing fingers, live up to their agreements, take responsibility, and clean up the Amazon.
Jack, you've been following this story a bit closer. Big oil company wins lawsuit against indigenous Ecuadorians. Was this simply a victory for corporate power?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that, and the whole case has been pretty divisive. Essentially, Texaco was working in Ecuador back in the 70s and 80s in partnership with the state-owned company Petroecuador. Now, Texaco left Ecuador in 1992, and Petroecuador obviously remained. Texaco was accused of having failed to clean up after themselves, basically, leaving huge areas contaminated, and a lawsuit was then filed against them, led by the lawyer Stephen Donziger. Chevron purchased Texaco in 2001, so in essence they inherited the case. Now, what they say is that Texaco actually fulfilled all of its promises to clean up after itself before it left Ecuador, and that it was the state-run Petroecuador that failed to keep their end of the bargain, and that the case brought against Chevron is, as you heard in that clip there, opportunistic, fraudulent, and motivated by money. In particular, they claim that the prosecuting lawyer, Stephen Donziger, has been using this essentially as a means to earn a big paycheck all along. Chevron has argued that Donziger opened secret offshore accounts in preparation for payouts, and that his team fabricated evidence and abused a corrupt legal system in Ecuador. In particular, they point to outtakes from the documentary film Crude, which was sympathetic to Chevron's opponents. Outtakes, they argue, proved their accusations of fraud.
The only language that I believe this judge is going to understand is one of pressure, intimidation, and humiliation. And that's what we're doing today. We're going to let him know what time it is. I hate doing it. I hate doing this stuff. I don't feel comfortable doing it. As a lawyer, I never do this. You don't have to do it in the United States. It's dirty. I hate it. I hate it, but it's necessary.
Stephen Donziger speaking during one of the outtakes of the documentary film Crude. We did try to get someone from Chevron onto the programme, but unfortunately no one was available. We do, however, have Paul Passimino on the line from New York. He's the Associate Director of Amazon Watch, a non-profit organisation that has been campaigning with the Clean Up Ecuador campaign for the last 14 years. Thank you for talking to us, Paul. Chevron have maintained that Texaco fulfilled its obligations before pulling out of Ecuador and that it was actually the state-run Petroecuador who failed to live up to their promises. So why then was this case aimed specifically at Chevron and not Petroecuador?
Well, first off, because Texaco was the sole operator and construction maker of the pits and the system in Ecuador, which makes them liable for 100% of the contamination. Their remediation, quote-unquote, only dealt with a small portion of the pits, and the release that they signed with the government did not release them for any civil liability. Then, when you add to that the fact that the places that they allegedly remediated were not cleaned, they were just dirt pushed over top of pits, which were demonstrated by their own leaked whistleblower videos sent to us from videos that they took, Chevron did, in 2005, showing Chevron's technicians finding toxic contamination at their former well sites and discovering that they couldn't use them for tests during the trial.
So what then was PetroEcuador's role in this?
Well, in 1993, PetroEcuador took over operations of the drilling system that Texaco had built. And it did indeed continue to contaminate because, in fact, the system had been designed to do so. There was no method to reinject the toxic foundation waters into the earth. So for several years, PetroEcuador operated it, and it did continue to pollute. Then they eventually upgraded the system so that it now does reinject the foundation waters into the earth. But in addition to that, there have been spills in the Amazon. PetroEcuador is not free from liability for contaminating the Amazon, not by any stretch. But there's no way that their operations in any way absolve Texaco for deliberately polluting and poisoning the drinking water of 30,000 people over the course of decades. It simply doesn't add up that if someone else comes in later and commits a crime, that absolves you of your own.
A huge amount of focus in this case has been on one man, Stephen Donziger, and Chevron have gone to great lengths to argue that he is effectively a crook. They've accused him of fabricating evidence, suggested that he in particular pursued the whole case for personal financial gain, citing so-called secret offshore accounts and things. Aside from the accusations leveled against Chevron, have you ever felt that there was any truth behind those sorts of claims?
No, not a shred. This is an example of Chevron making an example of someone who has worked so hard to bring them to account. They've tried to demonize and destroy Stephen Donziger because they don't want other people to bring similar cases. And if you were looking at this case as a human rights lawyer or an environmental lawyer to challenge Chevron or any other large oil company, it would give you great pause before you decided to dedicate yourself to it when you look at what they've done to Stephen Donziger. His work, he's worked tirelessly for decades now to bring this case, despite them trying to literally destroy his career and his family. And it's amazing that he's been able to hold through this entire ordeal. But no, there's absolutely no evidence of actual corruption. Chevron's case against him rests on the testimony of a corrupt judge who was paid $2 million by Chevron and admitted to testify against him. And he offered up no actual evidence of a ghostwritten verdict or a bribe, and yet the government of Ecuador has produced forensic reports of the computer of the judge who actually wrote the judgment in Lago Agrio, and it proves that that judgment was written on one computer over time. No external devices were attached to it. So basically, the case against Stephen has been thrown out. All they have against him are some flamboyant comments that he's made in the documentary Crude, which is the case of one person trying to take on a massive oil company over the case of years that wanted to destroy his efforts. So, of course, there's very cynical attitudes in there. Of course, there are things that he has said over time that sound like, you know, how am I ever going to win because they've got the game rigged against me. So they've twisted and turned that to try to demonize Donziger. And unfortunately, to a certain degree, it has worked. And that has made it harder for any other human rights and environmental attorney to bring a similar case against a large corporation.
Well, I think you sort of hinted at it, but just finally, given the extent to which this has been dragged through seemingly every court in the land over decades now, it's been in the USA and then it was in Ecuador and then it's back in the USA. Can it be argued now that maybe justice must have been done?
No. Well, first of all, justice was done in 2011 when the Ecuadorians won their verdict. That victory is complete. It's been confirmed by the Supreme Court of Ecuador, and that is the first time that any indigenous and affected communities in their own country successfully sued a U.S. oil company. Now, that verdict has been verified, and it is enforceable anywhere in the world except the United States. And the verdict that came out the other week, all it says is that if the Ecuadorians ever try to enforce their verdict in the United States, they can't do so. It was a preemptive strike by Chevron. It was not a reevaluation of the evidence. In fact, it specifically forbade any discussion or evidence of contamination in the trial in New York. So the next stage of this is where the Ecuadorians simply enforce the verdict. They're debt collecting from a deadbeat dad who refuses to pay his bills, which is Chevron. And next month in Canada, they will there sue to seize some of Chevron's $15 billion worth of assets to cover their liability. And the Supreme Court of Canada has sided unanimously with the Ecuadorians to give them the right to do so.
So the case continues.
And of course, Chevron is going to do everything it can to drag that out for years, too. It refuses to acknowledge the liability to its own shareholders. So when the Ecuadorians win that case, Chevron will appeal, and it'll undoubtedly go back to the Supreme Court of Canada. We may be looking at 3, 4, or 5 more years before there's an ultimate resolution in Canada. But if it goes the way we expect it will, on that day, Chevron will actually have to pay. And that will send shockwaves through the boardrooms of many oil companies around the world.
Paul Pasimino, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thank you.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Still to come on the programme, as the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen intensifies its bombing campaign, with reports of 14 Yemeni children being killed in airstrikes on Saturday, we look at attempts within the American Senate to challenge further arms sales to the Gulf Kingdom.
A Northern Ireland victims campaigner has launched a legal challenge to the UK's leaving the European Union amid concerns that EU peace money, which goes towards victims of the Troubles, could be discontinued in the event of Brexit.
Jonathan Pollard, a former Israeli spy, has seen his bid to overturn restrictive probation conditions refused. But just who is Jonathan Pollard?
And refugees in Germany are paying it forward. Refugee students at the Ready School for Digital Integration have developed a new app to help other refugees and asylum seekers deal with the complex paperwork they face when arriving in the country.
The Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul has announced his intention to try and block a recent deal between the Obama administration and Saudi Arabia, which would see a huge sale of weapons to the Gulf Kingdom. Rand Paul's position runs counter to the approach adopted by the American government, which openly embraces a policy of arming Saudi Arabia to the tune of billions of dollars worth of weapons each year. Sputnik's Matthew Eaton has more.
Just days after the Obama administration approved a $1.5 billion arms deal to Saudi Arabia, Kentucky Republican Senator Ron Paul announced that he's looking for ways to try and block the sale. The deal would include the sale of 130 Abrams battle tanks, 20 armoured vehicles, and other military equipment. The deal has been deplored by human rights groups such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. Ron Paul has said that, quote, "I will work with a bipartisan coalition to explore forcing a vote on blocking this sale. Saudi Arabia is an unreliable ally with a poor human rights record. We should not rush to sell them advanced weapons and promote an arms race in the Middle East." Paul's statement comes at a time when Saudi Arabia has intensified its bombardment of Yemen. It was reported over the weekend that Riyadh killed at least 14 children in an airstrike on a small village school in Sadr province earlier on Saturday morning. The children were on summer holiday and were gathering for a religious class. Doctors Without Borders announced that at least 28 others were wounded in the attack, and that all of the victims were aged somewhere between 8 and 15 years old. Saudi Arabia has seemingly tried to justify the attack by arguing that the children were, quote, child soldiers, yet has provided no evidence to support the claim. Joining us now to discuss this more is Lindsay German of the Stop the War Coalition. So first of all, Lindsay, thank you for agreeing to join us here on Sputnik Radio.
You're very welcome.
So obviously Senator Ron Paul's argument that huge arms sales to Saudi Arabia should be banned is a welcome one. But what are the chances that his voice will actually be listened to, do you think?
Well, it is welcome because I think many, many people around the world are alarmed at the increasing way in which Saudi Arabia is amassing arms, and it has expanded its armaments and its military presence massively over in the 21st century. We know that it's engaged in a very brutal war in Yemen. And I think people are very worried about this. The chances of it, I think, are obviously much more remote because, unfortunately, there are many, many arms deals to regimes which shouldn't be sent arms and shouldn't be sold arms. It's obvious from the British government, this has been going on from the British government, and indeed the British industry, the British arms industry is quite is very involved with Saudi Arabia, with all the problems that entails. And indeed, at the end of the last session of the British Parliament, there were various points made where it was admitted that there hadn't been the proper oversight on these arms. In other words, that they could be being used against civilians and they could be used against their own population. So we're hoping that things can be done, and various campaigners do campaign around these issues. But I think realistically, we also have to say that it's in the interests of many governments and many arms industries themselves to continue these arms sales.
Yeah, and as you alluded to, Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen has, according to reputable human rights organisations, killed upward of about 3,000 people, mostly civilians. So why is the US government not reining in on its funding and arming of this country?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, if you look at the Middle East at the moment, there's, of course, terrible war and terrible bombing going on in Syria. But this isn't the only place where it's going on, and it is also going on in Yemen, where Saudi is very complicit. There's just been the news of the bombing of a school with a number of children killed. Now, obviously, this is something which is totally unacceptable. It's unacceptable under international law, but it's unacceptable in any civilised society that these children are the victims. And the fact that the Saudis and the Yemeni government claim that this is, you know, these are child soldiers shouldn't make any difference to this at all. It is wrong, full stop. You know, we shouldn't be doing it.
Okay, Lindsay German with the Stop the War Coalition, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
A Northern Ireland victims campaigner has launched a legal challenge to the UK leaving the European Union. Raymond McCord, whose son Raymond Jr. was murdered by the Loyalist Paramilitary Ulster Volunteer Force, or UVF, in North Belfast in 1997, is believed to be the first person in Northern Ireland to issue proceedings over Brexit. He is taking the case amid concerns that European peace money, which goes towards the victims of the Troubles, may be discontinued. The challenge centres on the government's response to the June 23rd referendum result. Although the UK-wide result of the referendum was 52% leave and 48% remain, in Northern Ireland itself, 56% voted to remain. Our reporter Jim Ensom has been talking to the lawyers acting for Mr. McCord. Jim, thanks for talking to us. Could you just explain, first of all, who Mr. McCord is?
He's a 62-year-old man. He's a British citizen and resident of Northern Ireland. And for many years, he's acted as a victims campaigner, as you said, following the murder of the eldest of his three sons, Raymond McCord Jr., by the UVS in 1997. Now, he's dedicated much of his life to campaigning on behalf of victims and seeking justice in respect of his son's murder. He made a breakthrough in 2002 when he met the police ombudsman in New Ireland alone, who conducted an investigation into his son's murder, and the results were published 5 years later. So that began Operation Ballast and focused on collusion between the Royal Ulster Constabulary and the UVS. And basically, the whole peace process, he argues, is based on the fundamental recognition of equality of traditions and on a shared future of the UK and the Republic of Ireland within the European Union. That's the main issue.
So what's the basis, then, of his claim?
Well, he's saying that basically Article 50, the exit push button to get out following the referendum, should not be done on the Queen's prerogative. In other words, they can't invoke simply Article 50 straight away as a government. It would need to be voted on in the House of Commons first. In other words, it's possible that the whole of the House of Commons could actually vote not to press the exit button and invoke Article 50. And he's saying that because of the Northern Ireland peace process, it therefore must be up for judicial review to prevent it being done on the Queen's prerogative. In other words, the automatic triggering of Article 50, which is what Theresa May has said.
You've seen the court papers, Jim. What do they say?
Well, I mean, basically, the affidavit is outlined as roughly as I've said. What he says is that he has been in correspondence with various people, and they're now seeking to challenge the various courts, because basically the court papers are terribly complicated, I can tell you. I've got them in front of me at the moment. But he's bringing an action basically against three: Her Majesty's Government, the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, and the Secretary of State for exiting the European Union. So that's who he's going up against at the moment. We don't know when it's going to be heard, but certainly he's arguing that the whole of the triggering process of Article 50 must be delayed before a vote of Parliament can be voted on it. Because, of course, both Scotland and Northern Ireland fundamentally voted to remain, and it was only England and Wales that voted to get out. But, of course, it's the overall result of that referendum which counts.
And what then should we expect in terms of the most likely outcome?
Do you know, I honestly can't tell you. Stranger things have happened over the last 6 or 7 weeks in British politics, and I must say the ups and downs of the Brexit still eludes me. It's very difficult to see how the judges can say whether or not the royal prerogative can be overruled and set to a vote in Parliament. I mean, it has to go first to Northern Ireland, then perhaps could even end up in the Supreme Court in London, but certainly it's going to have to happen pretty quickly. I know that they're dragging their feet at the moment because of Parliament recess, at the European Parliament recess, on the triggering of Article 50. The idea was that it could be triggered before the end of this year. This is likely to delay it.
Jim Ensom, thank you.
Jonathan Pollard, a former US Navy intelligence officer convicted of spying for Israel, has lost a bid to have restrictive probation conditions imposed upon him overturned after serving 30 years in prison. The US District Judge Catherine Forrest denied Pollard's challenge requirements imposed by the US Parole Commission that he wear an electronic tracking device around his ankle and submit his work computer for monitoring.
Pollard also faced a 5-year-long ban on flying after he was released from prison last year. Mr. Pollard's lawyers have also tried to challenge this, which has hampered his chances of being able to fulfil his desire to emigrate to Israel, where his wife lives and where he was granted citizenship while he was in prison. Upon Pollard's release, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that he had, quote, dreamed of this day.
Mr. Pollard was arrested on November 1st, 1985, after it was concluded that suspicions... After it was concluded that he was spying for Israel, were indeed correct, I'm sorry about that, he was convicted in 1987 to a life sentence for one count of espionage. Pollard was paid $10,000 and lavished with jewels and trips to foreign destinations to steal classified documents from US government archives and hand them over to Israeli intelligence, by whom he was directly employed.
The stolen documents, which Pollard handed over by the suitcase load, included information on Arab and Soviet weaponry, as well as a guide to US signals intelligence, media reports and information on US weapons systems. In an article for Foreign Policy, retired Admiral Thomas Brooks said that Pollard's spying actions have been, quote, exceeded only by Edward Snowden. Earlier today, Sputnik's Matthew Eaton spoke to Philip Giraldi, a former counter-terror specialist and military intelligence officer with the CIA.
I'd like to ask, a lot of people might be a bit confused about the situation with Mr. Pollard, because obviously the United States and Israel are very close allies, but Mr. Pollard was leaking US secrets to Israel. I mean, why was that, and what sort of classified information did Mr. Pollard leak?
Well, in spite of the fact that the relationship between the United States and Israel is very friendly, nations are competitors, essentially, in terms of the kind of information that they seek to have to give them advantages. Israel has consistently spied on the United States. Pollard is perhaps the best-known case. He was arrested in 1985, convicted in 87, spent 30 years in jail, and still is on probation, where his movements and what he does is being monitored.
What was the nature of the information that he leaked? What exactly was the information? What did it contain?
Well, that was the interesting part of it. He basically was stealing the entire supermarket. He was essentially taking information of all kinds. It was estimated that he eventually stole an entire room full of highly classified documents, and these were passed on to Israel, and some of the documents were in turn passed on to the Soviet Union at that time by the Israelis in exchange for favors that the Russians were giving to the Israeli government. So it's a very complicated case. Many consider it to be the biggest espionage case of all time directed against the United States.
Okay, Mr. Pollard he's revered on the Israeli right, often as a hero, but often lambasted as a traitor in the United States. Do you think it's fair to call him a traitor, or is that a bit harsh? What do you think?
Well, he certainly was a traitor in that he swore an oath to protect the classified information, and he did something quite different. The Israelis, of course, claimed that he was doing this to secure or to make Israel more secure by giving them information they needed to have. But, of course, the fact is, as I said before, he was stealing all kinds of information and had nothing to do with Israel's national security. So in a sense, it depends, I guess, where you're sitting and exactly how you look at it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Phil Giraldi, that's all we've got time for, but thank you very much.
Quite all right.
Berlin's Ready School of Digital Integration is a non-profit organisation that, as its tagline states, offers an integrated and accelerated approach to provide refugees with real-world IT skills.
The work seems to have paid off, and the refugee developers are paying it forward with a new app aimed at helping future refugees and asylum seekers make sense of the complex application processes. The app, which is called Bureau Crazy, helps with issues such as applying for housing, healthcare and starting a bank account, as well as breaking down the complexities of asylum applications.
Joining me on the line is Anna Kier Reichart, founder of the Ready School. Anna, can you just tell us how you came about founding this school?
The idea basically came in August last year when I was visiting a refugee center in the north of Berlin, where I sat down and I had a fascinating conversation with a guy called Mohammed, who was a young man in his mid-20s, who arrived in Berlin 2 years ago from Baghdad. And he was telling me how he had studied computer science at Baghdad University for 3 years. But since he arrived in Germany, he hasn't been able to continue programming simply because he was lacking a laptop. And I just thought it was absolutely ridiculous that, he was a young, motivated man who was speaking really good English, who was learning German, who really wanted to either continue studying or get a job in the IT industry in Germany. And the only thing that kind of stood in his way was the lack of a laptop. So the initial idea really came from there and say, okay, how can I help this one person? But then realized, there's probably so many other people in a similar situation to him. And at the same time, really trying to see, okay, how could we create a win-win situation out of it, where on the one hand side, the German industry currently has 43,000 available jobs in the IT industry. They're absolutely desperate for talent and young people who are motivated to work in IT. And then on the other hand, you have refugees who come here who are really interested in getting a job to become financially independent and potentially also help their families back home. So for me, it was kind of the penny dropped in that conversation, and then we got to work.
This app that's been developed to help other refugees and asylum seekers deal with the often complex paperwork that they face, it sounds like the ultimate pay it forward scheme. Was this the idea of the refugees involved? Did they want to help other refugees and asylum seekers?
Absolutely, it was. So the way that our school runs is that we're teaching coding and different digital skills. But the way that our students work is always in groups where they're working on projects that are really relevant to them. So even before you start learning to code, we sit down with our students and map out what some of the challenges are in their daily life in Berlin that they are facing and how technology can help solve it. And I was actually lucky enough to work with the Bureau Crazy group from the very first day and saw them develop this idea of Bureau Crazy. And then they've spent 4 months working with volunteer teachers and mentors to actually build it and take it one step closer to reality.
Just finally, the work you're doing, do you see this having a positive impact on an often stigmatized demographic, or the local community becoming more aware of these skills that these refugees have?
I definitely think so. It's been wonderful to just see the human development amongst our students and see, Rami, one of our guys from Syria, who basically came in through the program, was sitting a little bit shy in the corner with a big jacket on, and giving him opportunities like go to Cisco and make a presentation. He met Mark Zuckerberg when he came to visit the school, and now he just looks like any other guy working in the IT industry with a cap and a cool jump shirt, and it's just wonderful to see the, you know, just the human development. And then on the other hand, I think our teachers and mentors have had a really eye-opening experience getting to know the students really well, working together with them on projects. Because really to us, integration is a two-way process. So it's not just the refugees having to change and become more German. It's really taking the best from two different cultures and make something truly unique and innovative together.
Anna, thank you very much for joining us on the show today.
Yeah, my absolute pleasure.
Anna here, Reichardt from the Ready School for Digital Integration there. And that's all that we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget that you can find out more about everything we were discussing and a whole lot more over at sputniknews.com.
This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Till tomorrow, from me, Jack Foster.
And from me, Carolyn Scott.
Goodbye.